And I believe we have a quorum. We do. And members, today we're going to do a couple of things. We're going to have an overview of the environmental public health tracking report on that from the Minnesota Department of Health. I have a bill on asthma that we'll be going over, and then we'll also be having a final action on Representative Hayden's bill, which we had quite an extensive hearing on about a week or so ago. And let's see, first day, we have the minutes from the last meeting, I could believe, in the folder. Representative Benson, I see that you have read them.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Okay, Representative Benson moves approval of the minutes from, what's the date on that? That's from our last meeting.
January 28th.
Oh, excuse me, there are four different minutes? Okay.
We have several.
Okay, the interim hearings. Any discussion on the minutes? Any corrections or changes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted. So we'll start with the overview of the Environmental Public Health Tracking Program. And Dr. Johnson, I believe you're here. And welcome to the committee. I'm sorry about the technical glitch. I think that affects what you were going to share with us, right?
Yes.
Is there, do you have anything, a handout, or is there a PowerPoint? I think you had a PowerPoint, and we have a copy of that for our...
There should be a handout.
It's in the folders, members, so if you could just refer to that. I apologize for the technical problem. We didn't realize it until we got into the room. So welcome to the committee, and if you just go ahead, we...
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Can you hear me okay? Is this okay? Yes, there should be a couple of handouts in front of you. One would be a copy of the slide presentation, and I'll do my best to talk through and let you know which order of the slides so that you're able to follow along since you won't be viewing them on the screen. And then the other handout that you should have in front of you is just an update called Minnesota Department of Health Biomonitoring Pilot Projects at a Glance, update February 2010. And I'll be referring to that as well.
Okay.
Again, I want to thank you for this opportunity to give you an update on our program, which is called Environmental Public Health Tracking and Biomonitoring. There have been several new developments in this program in the past year that I wanted to update you on, and also talk a little bit about the things that we're working on currently and will be doing over the next year. Some of you may recall the Environmental Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program started here in Minnesota in 2007 with the passage of new state legislation that created the program. And I'm now on my second slide. And in that statute, the definition of environmental health tracking is the collection, integration, analysis, and dissemination of data on human exposures to chemicals in the environment and on diseases potentially caused or aggravated by those chemicals. I'm sorry, I think I should have introduced myself right from the start. I think I neglected to
do that. Go ahead, Dr. Johnson.
My name is Jean Johnson, and I am the program director for the Tracking and Biomonitoring Program. I'm also an environmental epidemiologist. Our program, as we began to develop it, we were actually following a model already in front of us that was set by the National Environmental Public Health Tracking Program by the CDC. The CDC at that time was funding 16 states in the national program. Minnesota was not one of them. But the purpose of that program has been, and similar to ours, to bring together the pieces of the many state programs that collect data about environment and health, and to try to pull that information together so that we can see how those pieces fit together. That's the goal of the national program. That was also the goal of our program. Jumping to the next slide, bridging the environmental public health gap. The tracking system collects basically three kinds of data. Hazard data measures the chemicals that are in air, water, food, soil, in our homes and in our buildings. Exposure data includes measures of chemicals in the body, so that would be things like blood, lead, and biomonitoring data. And, of course, disease data, which measures health in populations. The tracking system does not collect new data, but rather it pulls together existing data from a wide variety of sources, and we try to make use of that data in new ways. So, for example, hazard data, which we look at air monitoring data that's collected by the Pollution Control Agency for regulatory purposes, we look at that data, same data, to see if we can use that to look at population exposure to air pollutants. And similarly, we look at drinking water data that's collected by the Minnesota Drinking Water Information System, also for regulatory purposes. We look at that same data to see if we can use that to look at population exposure to drinking water contaminants. And for disease data, we pull data from a number of different disease surveillance systems in the state, such things as birth and death records, birth defect surveillance, and cancer surveillance. Exposure data, this is one area where there's not a lot of existing data available. We do have a blood lead information system, and we have a pilot biomonitoring program, but there really is not much out there that's available, certainly at a state level, that looks at chemicals in the human body. So that's actually something we've identified as a gap, which we think our biomonitoring program can help to address.
Excuse me, Ms. Nelson, could you say more about that part? Because that is one of the things I'm interested in understanding. The new data that you're gathering, for example, from the three mandated biomonitoring studies, I think there are three that we required to be done, maybe four. That would be new data.
Yes.
And so in that case, you are looking at new data, but it's, I wasn't quite sure when you said you're not collecting new data. Does that mean you'd have to wait until the legislature mandated a biomonitoring or some other sort of study before you would put it into this program of public health tracking?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's an excellent question, and actually my last slide, I'm going to talk about how we integrate biomonitoring into tracking.
Okay.
Right now, they operate sort of as two side-by-side separate programs, but it is actually our goal and also the CDC's goal to see how we can do a better job of integrating those projects. So I will
go back to that
question. But the tracking program itself, like I said, modeled after the national program, is focused solely on existing data that we can gather from other sources. So the next slide talks about what those core tracking content areas are. These are the national areas, and these are also the ones we've been working on for the past 2 years in collecting data. They include air quality, drinking water, lead poisoning, hospitalizations for asthma, COPD, and myocardial infarctions, birth defects, birth outcomes, selected cancer, and carbon monoxide poisoning. So those are our eight core content areas. The good news is our efforts to keep this our state program as consistent as possible with the national program, we were hoping that should another funding opportunity come from the CDC that we would be competitive for that. And the good news is they did open up funding to six new states last summer. We applied for that funds, and Minnesota is now a grantee, joining 21 other states around the country in a cooperative agreement with CDC to form and be part of the National Environmental Public Health Tracking Network. So this was a great example of state investment successfully leveraging federal dollars. So our data now will be combined with data that's collected in other states, and it will be available on a national portal that's at the CDC website. You'll be able to see not only our state's data, but you'll see it with other states as well. CDC launched their national portal this past summer. The next slide is actually a screenshot. It's entitled Tracking Portal for Data Access. A major emphasis of our program this year is data dissemination. It's also a key deliverable under our new tracking grant is to make data accessible to the public and to make it easy to understand, make it informative, make it useful. That dissemination, one of the key deliverables is a state portal. And that's something we're working on this year and we'll be also working on next year. That's an electronic network that will collect and integrate the data. All of the 16 states that are currently funded now have web-based portals, so you can see those online to get an idea of where we are going with our own Minnesota portal. The screenshot that I have on the slide here is actually New Mexico's tracking portal, but it's a good example of where we are going with our program. We plan to build and enhance our portal over the next couple of years. We'll be adding components to it like GIS capability. Initially, it's going to come out. It's going to be pretty bare bones, and it'll just have sort of basic tables and graphs. But over time, we plan to enhance and build that program. The next slide is many PTA EPHT data reports. Another way that we are disseminating data now is through a series of data reports in each of the 8 content areas. We've just published 3 of them on our website, and they are a report on carbon monoxide poisonings. This looks at data from death records, hospitalizations, and ED visits to look at the frequencies of those events over time. Next year, we plan to add survey data that is tracking the use of carbon monoxide detectors in homes. We expect that use will increase with the full implementation this year of the laws that require detectors in homes in 2009. We've also released a report on drinking water. Again, this is data from the Drinking Water Information System. The data in that report includes nitrates, arsenic, and disinfection byproduct concentrations in public water supplies. And we released a report on hospitalizations that looks at asthma, COPD, and heart attacks. All of those are outcomes which are affected by air pollution. Our website is also undergoing revision, and there will be more reports posted there in the future. The next 2 slides are actually just snapshots of what the data from those reports. A couple of those reports, I just put that in as examples so you could see what the data actually look like. EPHT is tracking COPD hospitalizations. This is actually the first time the health department has been tracking COPD. And looking at it much in the same way that we've been tracking asthma over the last several years. COPD, you may know, is the 5th leading cause of death in Minnesota, and while smoking is a major cause of COPD, the disease can be aggravated by many of the same environmental pollutants that cause exacerbations in asthma. Like asthma, COPD exacerbations result in costly hospitalizations, ED visits, and even deaths. This slide also shows you one of the ways that we can display data on a map so that we can look at geographic variation and trends over time. The other example I included here is some of the data from our carbon monoxide poisonings report. What I like about this one is that it can show how tracking can actually demonstrate the effect of public health actions. I mentioned the new state law that requires carbon monoxide detectors in home. That law has been slowly implemented over time. It started in 2007 and has gone into full implementation this year in 2009. Through our tracking data, what's interesting that we've observed, and I show it on these graphs, is that if you look at poison center calls in 2007 as a result of carbon monoxide, poison center calls actually increased in that year, which may be just an indication of better awareness. Those calls tend to come from parents, typically with concerns about their children and their families. But at that same time, in that same year, the number of deaths actually decreased. So hopefully as we track this over time, we'll be able to see the effect of that law that put more detectors in homes and reduce deaths further. There are a couple of areas that are developmental as far as new content areas in the state that we hope to be tracking in the future. Climate change is one of them. This is actually several states, and part of the national effort is also looking at how we can look at public health indicators to measure changes in climate in the future. So we're looking at things like heat-related illness and population vulnerability. Another newly developing content area is pesticides. We're looking at data that's available on pesticide-associated illnesses as well as pesticide hazards in the environment. And then we're exploring what other new data and measures that are of interest to Minnesota. And finally, just kind of to summarize, I'm looking at the slide that is called Environmental Health Tracking System, Using Data to Drive Public Health Action. A good tracking system, like any surveillance system, is designed to provide data that supports action being education, intervention, policy, and research in some cases. And hopefully, as this program grows and develops, we'll begin to see that go into play. Our focus is on high-quality data, making that data widely accessible and useful for those who can put that data to action. The next slide I'm going to talk about is the biomonitoring pilot program. As I mentioned, this program is sort of operating side by side with tracking. It is a pilot. It requires started in 2007. Biomonitoring is a measure of chemicals and their metabolites in human biological specimens. The pilot program was to develop and conduct 4 pilot projects and specifically the chemicals we were to monitor were perfluoric chemicals, or PFCs, arsenic, mercury, and the fourth project was to be chosen. Working with our advisory panel, the chemicals we chose for that fourth project are BPA and related environmental phenols, and cotinine, which is a byproduct essentially of nicotine. It's used as an indicator of environmental tobacco smoke when you look at it in non-smokers. Each of these projects under the law are to be done in communities that we identify as likely to be exposed. And ultimately, the goal of this pilot program is to take the lessons learned from these pilots and to come back to the legislature with recommendations for an ongoing program in the state. I did, since I knew there wouldn't be time to go through all four pilots, I thought the best thing to do would be to summarize that for you in a handout. There's a description here of each of the pilot projects and the population that's included in each of them and their status currently. I think what you'll see if you read through these is that there's a lot of variety in these pilots. There's variety in terms of the communities that are being studied. There's rural, there's urban, there's suburban. The ages are all variable. There's one that's in children, one in adults, one in pregnant women, and one in newborns. The types of exposures are all different. A couple of them involve particular contamination in communities. With mercury, we're looking at probably fish consumption. And then different types of specimens, urine, blood, and newborn dried blood spots. So there's a lot of variety there and a lot that we can learn, a lot of lessons we can take from these projects. Two of the projects are completed at this point. The Minneapolis Children's Arsenic Study is completed, and a report is available on our website. And the East Metro PFC biomonitoring project is also complete, and that report with all the results is available on the website. The other two studies are still ongoing this year. Both we expect to complete this year. The Lake Superior Mercury Biomonitoring Study is actually an EPA-funded project. It's being conducted in collaboration with Michigan and Wisconsin, and that study is still recruiting and getting informed consent from the parents for analysis of those spots for mercury levels. And then the Riverside Prenatal Biomonitoring Study is also still in the phase of doing recruitment, consent, and collecting urine samples from, this is looking at pregnant women, and we're going to be looking at BPA and cotinine. All the analyses for these projects are being done by our health department's public health laboratory. They are all done with the informed consent of the participant. And we expect those last two we expect to complete this year and hope to have reports on our website for those soon. Just to kind of wrap up, I think I have two or three slides left. We will be this year begin working on developing recommendations for an ongoing program. We hope to be back in the legislative session here next year with those recommendations. We've been working with our advisory panel on developing a statement of vision and purpose for what a state biomonitoring program could and should do, best practices, strategies, and methods, and a criteria and a process for selecting chemicals for future biomonitoring. And then finally, to come back to the issue about how do we integrate biomonitoring and tracking together. This has been identified by a number of the stakeholders we talked to, that there is a need for greater connection between tracking programs and biomonitoring. In fact, our state is the only state that has a law and a program in place that puts these two things together. States that have them, they typically operate separately. But stakeholders have identified the fact that the purpose of biomonitoring is most useful when it's integrated with environmental health tracking, when we can look at health outcomes. And they've also said that an integrated approach is needed so that we can tie our data to actions and prove that regulation is working. And so that's also a direction we hope to go as we develop these programs. And I think with that, I will stop. Our website information is there if you need any other information. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have a number of members who have questions. I just want to start with one based on your last comment, which was connecting the biomonitoring and tracking. What actually are you going to do? I think it's critically important that you do that. What are you going to do?
That's a very good question. It's one we're going to be working on this year. one of the ways to integrate them, since tracking looks at is an ongoing surveillance program where we take existing data that's collected over several years and we track that over time. In order for biomonitoring to integrate with tracking, we would need to take that same approach with a biomonitoring program. Rather than having, you know, just a series of projects that give you basically snapshots of a community, to integrate with tracking, we would need to have a biomonitoring program that looks at it over time, that measures chemicals over time in some ongoing systematic way.
Okay, and Ms. Johnson, how are you going to decide which contaminants, which exposures you're going to be tracking, biomonitoring and then tracking?
Yes, Madam Chair. Well, we would look to our advisory panel to help us. That's one of the things we will be working on this year, is trying to come up with what would be the best strategies and methods to make those selections.
Right.
So that's something that we're working on this year. Good question.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I do think, you know, the legislature has acted on this in the past, too. I think there's probably members here who have some ideas of things they might, in their own communities, they might want to suggest to you as well. And you know, maybe you saw later on in the agenda today, we're dealing with the issue of asthma. And the environmental sources of asthma in terms of that, I'm wondering, are you looking at that as one of the health conditions that you might develop with your both biomonitoring and public health tracking?
Yes, Madam Chair. Asthma is one of the areas that we are tracking. In our hospitalizations report, we have asthma hospitalizations. We also are looking at how we can integrate asthma hospitalizations with air pollution data and how we can measure that relationship. We actually have another grant, an EPA grant, that's looking at developing those methods, and then we plan to apply those methods to the tracking program.
Okay. Well, I'll go to the other members here. I have a couple questions, but Representative Severson, I think you were first.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Johnson, in terms of the grant you said you got through the CDC that was awarded, I guess a couple questions. Number one was, when the legislation was passed in 2007, was there a allocation of dollars that were allocated to the department? How was that offset by the grant? How long is the grant for? How many FTEs do you have? And what's your projected budget going to the end of the report period that comes back to the legislature to with your proposal?
Ms. Johnson.
Yes, Madam Chair. The original allocation from the state in 2007, I believe, was approximately $1 million, of which I think $900,000 was allocated to the State Health Department. Oh, good. I see John is there, so he's going to correct me as I'm going on memory here. And then in this next funding cycle, those funds, would you like to address that question? Okay. I can address the question on the grant. How about that?
Okay.
The grant funding is $875,000 per year for 5 years, which started in August of this past year, 2009.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Stein, I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Health. Representative Severson, the original budget that passed with the 2007 legislation was $1 million out of this Environment and Natural Resources Fund. Those dollars were allocated to the Pollution Control Agency. They transferred $900,000 to the Minnesota Department of Health for staff for the environmental public health tracking and biomonitoring programs. So we had $900,000 in the initial allocation. That was then reduced in the last biennial budget to $500,000, which then Pollution Control Agency again kept a portion of those funds, $75,000 for their program, and $425,000 to the Department of Health for our efforts. So the tracking dollars, the grant program dollars that we received from the CDC augmented those state funds. The current number of FTEs, I don't have in my, we'll just get you the exact numbers of FTEs and our programmatic funding. We split out the money over the years according to how many biomonitoring projects we're going to do, because some of the costs of biomonitoring projects are the cost of analytical work in our laboratory, the costs of getting information out to the public and recruiting volunteers for those pilot projects. The vast majority of the funds, though, then are operational costs of the department. So we'll get you the breakdown by years of those funds and the number of FTEs that are allocated.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Severson.
And just to the five-year grant process, my understanding then is that the million comes out of the PCA budget, goes to partially goes to the Department of Health. Is that the ongoing, and is that going to be subject to unallotment, or is that going to be kept from that process? I understand the importance of keeping continuity of data, but you know, we've also got a budget crunch here and trying to figure out what's the best way to facilitate this. If the federal dollars are a way to continue this, then I guess that's what part of the picture needs to be put into focus here.
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, the governor has not proposed any reductions in the funding from the Environment and Natural Resources Fund for this program in the current biennium. Whether or not the governor did not unallot any portion of those funds in the last biennium, there were some reductions taken by the Pollution Control Agency in their allocation. But the health department is continuing to receive the annual transfer of about $425,000 from that original allocation that was then reduced in the subsequent biennium. So that's our current understanding, is that it's not proposed for reduction in the governor's budget from what we anticipate.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Dr. Johnson, I just would like to hear a little bit more about how you share data with the Department of Ag, specifically related to air quality issues and pesticide. I know you had those indicated on a couple of slides. But presumably, the Department of Health has a fair amount of data on that. And I would like to know how you share that and if they are forthcoming and helpful in answering questions, you know, that would be mutually beneficial between the departments. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, currently the air data that we are getting, which is part of, again, those core content areas that I mentioned that the national program is tracking, includes particulate matter and ozone only at this point. So we do not at this time have any air data with relates to pesticides. And the pesticide data is actually under development currently. So we're just at the earliest stages of exploring what data sets are out there, and we are working. We have someone at the Department of Agriculture who works on our technical team and works with us on trying to identify all those data sources and data sets that are out there. So we're really still at the earliest stages of that.
Hey, Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, if I could just comment on our existing program efforts between the Department of Agriculture that does the registration for pesticides and takes complaints from property owners associated with aerial application and drift from pesticide application in parts of the state. The Department of Agriculture oversees that entire process of concerns that are raised by citizens about aerial drift and information that the pesticide applicators are required to report on an annual basis. The Department of Health does provide support for folks who contact the Department of Agriculture with health-related concerns associated with pesticide exposures, and those folks contact our Environmental Health Division and then get referrals for services and information they could use to help them proceed with more inquiry around health-related effects of pesticide exposures.
Madam Chair, a follow-up. Do you have plans in this, your new program here with the biomonitoring and the tracking, to work more closely with the department? You have just said that they pretty much kind of take care of one area, but if you have plans, if you have a committee, are they part of that so that you're actually both there regarding these complaints or just issues that come up from tracking any of the pesticide drift or more than that? It's certainly much more expansive than that.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, we actually are looking right now at data use agreements and memorandums of understanding. We're working much more closely with Ag this year, I think, than we have in the last 2 years. And that is partly driven by the fact, as I say, the national program has identified pesticides as one of their new priority content areas. So I see that relationship growing, yes. And they are a regular member of our technical team and on our advisory panel and on the steering committee as well. So they are represented in three different places.
Representative Saylor, just let me comment. I mean, you and I have both been here through some hearings where there's been extreme concern and extreme frustration from citizens who, especially in Red River Valley and other places, who've had big concerns about pesticide-driven health concerns, and they've really not found, I think, in the past, you know, the way to get into your system and the office that you have there. So I guess maybe what you're saying to Representative Saylor is there's more, more of a structure now that they could respond, that you could respond with them to. Is that true? If citizens could bring this concern to you and not have to go through the Department of Ag?
Well, Madam Chair, what the tracking program will do will provide more of the what we know about pesticides and pesticide exposures as we track that information over time and geographically. One of the things that this program doesn't do, it provides additional information about pesticide exposures and risks, public health risks associated with those exposures. But it isn't a change to the basic pesticide registration process that the Department of Agriculture administers. So there are dual and parallel kinds of efforts in the two agencies, but I wouldn't want you to think that we're going to have a much more robust set of staff to contact individual landowners regarding their complaints. We'll continue to do what we've been doing, which is respond to those complaints and assist members of the public in getting information about exposure risks. But this program didn't increase the funding for that activity.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just curious, Dr. Johnson, on the results of the arsenic study and then the other study. I know you said those are online, but could you kind of give us just a synopsis of those two studies, what the outcome was?
Dr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the arsenic project was completed. We successfully enrolled 65 children from South Minneapolis. This was an area that had contamination in the soil. So we were specifically trying to target families with homes that had contaminated soil. And we collected urine samples from those children. We looked at the average levels, and we also looked at the range that we measured, and we compared that to, there is a national biomonitoring program that the CDC publishes data, and so we were able to compare our group, our 65 kids, to the national levels. And the levels are comparable to what's seen nationally. They're typical of what's seen in an urban community. They were a little bit higher than the national average. But they were still not at a level of that would cause any sort of health effects, even at chronic exposure. But the other thing we did is we speciated the arsenic, so we looked at we can separate out organic from inorganic, and that helps you to see how much of it might have come from food and diet. And it appeared that there were, although we had about three cases that were elevated, that appeared to be from diet and not from anything in the soil. And the other thing we did is we compared it to levels in the soil, and we didn't see soil as being a major contributor to the arsenic. It appears more to be a dietary contribution. The other one being PFCs. The East Metro project, we actually measured seven different perfluorochemicals. And this was done in blood serum, and we had 196 adults who participated in that. They were drawn from two communities, the Oakdale Municipal Water Community and the other community where people served by private wells in Lake Elmo and Cottage Grove. For those seven chemicals, there were three of them that were detected in all 196 participants. There were two that were not detected in any of them, and then there were two that were detected in only a few people, actually. The three that were detected in all of the participants, we compared those levels again to numbers that have been published in the National Biomonitoring Program, and we did find that the average levels in those two communities were elevated above the national levels. We think that probably is attributed to the drinking water contamination there, and we were able to actually have been able to show that now with some follow-up analysis that we've done comparing the well levels to the blood levels, and it does appear that the drinking water has contributed to exposure in that community. The good news is that exposure has been remedy with filters and other things that have been put into place. We expect the levels to come down over time due to the removal of that contamination. But even nationally, that's being seen. As these products have been phased out of production, even nationally, we can see that PFC levels are coming down over time. So.
Thank you.
Representative Howes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a two-faced question, but I want to make sure I understand what I'm talking about before I ask the question. You said that Department of Natural Resources transferred $1 million to the PCA. PCA gave the Department of Health $900,000. My question is, why is the DNR putting up this $1 million? Why wasn't it funded directly to you? And if then, in fact, they did give PCA $1 million, PCA give you $900,000, what happened to the $100,000?
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, the original budget and the legislation that enacted it was to take the dollars for this activity from the Environment Fund, for Environment and Natural Resources Fund. So none of the money goes to the Department of Natural Resources. All of the money is allocated to the Pollution Control Agency, who then is the responsible agency for administering that fund. Then they transfer, and this was all lined out in the original legislation, to transfer $900,000 to the Department of Health for program costs. The $100,000 that remains with the Pollution Control Agency is for their activities associated with air quality monitoring and other data that they provide for the environmental public health tracking work, because public health tracking system, as Dr. Johnson noted, uses data that are collected for a variety of purposes, both environmental quality data as well as public health data. And so it's a combination of data sets that are reside in a variety of agencies. So the Pollution Control Agency's $100,000 helps them to pay for the costs of collecting and managing that data.
Well, Madam Chair, it just seems to me that it makes more sense if you have one agency assigned a job or a task and let them do the whole scope of that task. I think you always get better results when you do that, and I think sometimes that's what happens with government. We get too many fingers on the same project, and we lose track of what's going on.
Well, Representative Howes, if I could just comment, maybe Mr. Stein or Dr. Johnson wants to comment too, but the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency doesn't have the capacity to do the biomonitoring and public health tracking. I would presume that we want the agency that really has that expertise to be the most efficient use of our dollars.
Madam Chair, it was better that you said that, so that me.
That's what I think. Okay. Just another question. I'm sorry we're kind of running out of time here because we got started late, but I do have another question. Yesterday's Star Tribune noted that 3M had talks, private secret talks, with folks here from our state about the perfluorochemicals, and with the US EPA, and we're not sure who all. It indicates that the author of the article says that you folks were left out. Is that true? Were you left out for this particular discussion? Well, maybe I'll start with that question. It just happened. Well, the newspaper is yesterday's article.
Sure, Madam Chair, the report is accurate. We were not invited to that meeting.
And Mr. Stein, what can you say about that?
I think that one of our staff were quoted in the article. Dr. Helen Gayden was quoted as being disappointed or disappointed that we probably would have asked some of the EPA researchers to come meet with us separately. 3M, as my understanding of this meeting was, 3M organized the meeting to talk with their some of the folks that have helped them with research and funded some of the research, and that they have partners that they wanted to meet with. And I don't certainly begrudge anybody the need to meet with their partners. I think our staff that were quoted in the article said something to the effect that we were disappointed or remiss that we didn't have the opportunity to meet with the EPA's senior researchers while they were in town. That would have been a nice opportunity for us to get together with them, but certainly there are, when government organizes meetings, there are public meetings. When private companies organize meetings, those are not necessarily public meetings. So with regard to that, I think our disappointment was that we missed an opportunity to meet with some very solid research folks from EPA and DuPont and other academic institutions around the country.
Well, my understanding is there's actually more than one meeting, and some of the same researchers also went to Washington to meet with the EPA, and you weren't invited to that either. That
Madam Chair, that's correct. The meetings they held locally, as I understand, were 2 days of meetings, but the meetings that they held in Washington, D.C., we had nothing to do with that.
So I guess, you know, one of my questions about this whole proliferative chemical investigation is where are we going with that? Where is the Department of Health's going with that? And I did have some concerns, and I know Dr. Johnson knows about this concern, that when you did the testing, the biomonitoring, you make a note of it again here, that children were eliminated from the study, the most vulnerable people in the area drinking the water were not any part of the study, which concerned me, and we talked about this publicly and privately. And I guess I'm just wondering, what is the health department's plan now in terms of the whole perfluorochemical issue, on now that we know that it's more pervasive than was thought, and that secret meetings are being held and so on? So what is the health department's plan?
Ms. Madam Chair, our advisory panel, when we presented the results to them, they actually did recommend that we plan for a follow-up to go back. As I mentioned, the expectation is that the levels in that community would be coming down over time because the drinking water has been remedied, and we do see that happening nationally. So there is a recommendation for us to look at going back and resampling in those same people again to see if we can actually measure that change. So there are plans underway to do that next year, and so we're working on that. I don't know if there's anything. Oh, right. And yes, we have talked about this before. The community was very concerned about children. In this particular study, we limited it to adults in the PFC community, and the reason was actually had to do with the ethics of including children in research. One of the things we've learned from doing these projects is that the ethical rules for children in research state that you're not to put children at risk in a study unless you also provide a health benefit to them. And in this case with PFCs, because we had no recommendation in terms of the result, it's not like when you do a blood lead test, you know, we have definite advice. We know what to do if we get an elevated level. We know what action needs to be taken. We know how to prevent the exposure. And we know something about the health effects. With PFCs, we know very little about the health effects, and there is no specific action to recommend. So we really couldn't justify a health benefit to the children that justified the risk of a blood draw, and it's about 20 cc's from the arm of a child, which if you've ever taken a child to the doctor and tried to do a blood draw, you know that can be very traumatic for a child. So given that ethical consideration, we did not include children in that project. So
you know, I just, having been a nurse, having done some of these kinds of tests, I just really question, you know, I was around when blood lead taken from children, you know, we didn't know either the seriousness at the time. And, you know, you got to begin somewhere. And I guess I have some big concerns that children, again, the most vulnerable people in the area, were excluded from the study on purpose. Parents who wanted to volunteer couldn't have their children tested. So I guess I'll let that go at this point. That's probably for more discussion. But I do continue to be concerned about that. I guess we have one more. Okay. Representative McNamara, I thought so.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two things. One, a follow-up. Assistant Commissioner Stein, in regards to the meeting between the EPA and 3M, I'm assuming, or I thought the way I read the article was that it was in reference to potential legislation or rulemaking process or whatever at the federal level. But I was surprised, because of your partnering in the past, I would have thought it would have been beneficial if they were coming here. So have you conveyed to 3M and the EPA that in the future, if they come to Minneapolis, that you've got a local phone number they can call?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, we have communicated with, I've had a brief conversation with the 3M's representatives, but you're correct that my understanding is that there were two sets of meetings, one that was here in the metropolitan area related to research, and that we certainly will let EPA know that we'd like to hear from them if they're coming up here to talk about PFC and research, because we do a fair amount of evaluation of that research in order to evaluate our health risk levels and information. So we will do that. The other meeting they had was in Washington, D.C., related to federal priorities and federal agency work that was separate from our responsibilities as a state agency.
Is that McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then on an unrelated topic, I'm not sure if it's for the Assistant Commissioner or Dr. Johnson, the carbon monoxide poisoning, what do we have on, I would imagine you're the agency we have, is there something on the website to help people? There's been a lot of change since we passed this legislation in the detectors today, especially the numeric ones, digital ones, are very, very good. Do you have any information on your website to help people when they're dealing with this?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I don't know if we have anything in specific about the different types of monitors or detectors. I'll go back and check on that. We do provide information on our website regarding the risks of exposure and what to do if you are exposed and have high levels of carbon monoxide exposure. Certainly, as Dr. Johnson noted, the majority of the way that we find out is from parents who contact the Poison Control Center or local hospitals regarding their concerns because they've had a high level of detection in their home and they want to find out what they need to do about that. So some of it is, some of our work is to identify those contacts and then look at how that changes geographically or over time as we implement these public health practices.
Real quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I did ask two questions, and thank you. The other one was, you have information to let people know about, it's your agency that if they look at carbon monoxide, it'll tell them something about it and the need to have the detectors and things,
Madam
like
Chair,
maybe some links?
Representative McNamara, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, I think unless there are any other questions from members, we'll move on. I guess I would be interested to hear, we didn't really get into this, but whether or not you're going to be seeking additional funding, I know not this year, but for some of these studies and the public health tracking in the next biennium, and that would be something I would be very interested in working with you on.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, members, we're going to go on to two bills, and the first one is my own bill, and I'll turn the chair over to Representative Lane. Members, the bill I'm bringing before you is a bill that builds on legislation that this committee actually passed and was included in legislation last year dealing with asthma. I'd like to ask a couple of folks to join me up here, Eliza Schell and Mary Manning. If you could.
All right, and I'll just remind everyone that we probably have about 20 minutes for this bill.
Right. So, and we have the other bill, too. So I'm going to move that House File 2582 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right.
So just very briefly, you should have in your packet an amendment that's the 582 DEI amendment. And I'm sure I'd like to move that amendment, and I can explain it. If you want to explain it first, I can do that very quickly. Basically, what this amendment does is it picks up, as I said, where we left off last year. We passed legislation that was a very small pilot project to try to look at the impact of being able to provide families for our medical assistants that have children with serious asthma and receive should be able to receive some durable medical equipment to help them both with preventing and treating their asthma. Mostly, I think we're really aiming at prevention here. But we had a very good study done by the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minneapolis Department of Health has been very involved too. We said that we wanted to have these products, which include things like HEPA
Do you need this back?
I'm sorry, you can't hear me?
Yeah, it's very muffled. I don't know if it's just me over here or...
Can't hear either.
You can't hear? Is that better?
That's
all right, I'll just put it right up very close. I moved an amendment that I'm trying to explain to you right now. An amendment is to legislation that we passed last year that allows medical assistants to pay for a pilot project to provide certain kinds of medical equipment that if a doctor prescribes them to children who have serious asthma problems. And by the time we got through the appropriation process, it was a very limited pilot. It only covered three cities, and specifically American Indian children in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth who have asthma problems that of the serious nature. They would be able to be provided with air purifier in their home if it was ordered, coverings for the bed that prevent the mite allergic response, HEPA filters on their vacuum cleaner or on their furnace, those sorts of things, if they were appropriate. And to determine if they were appropriate, one of the parts of the bill said that there would be a home assessment to determine the need. We know that these things are extremely helpful, extremely cost-efficient, based on the studies that we heard last year on this bill in this committee. And I have the two experts here who can go over that briefly if they want to and you want to hear about that. What we found out is that the environmental assessment, the home assessment, that home visit was not covered by medical assistance. So what this amendment does is goes back and says, okay, in order to make that law work, make that provision work, we need to cover the home assessment for the family that has a child with asthma. Look at those triggers, asthma triggers, with the medical assistance. So we have gone through a process of figuring out what does that cost. And we have that in a fiscal note for you, and I think I'll go ahead and let my two witnesses briefly give you the background of why this is important. Are you still having a hard time?
Clark, I think we need to move your amendment.
I moved it.
And then all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
And any opposed?
No.
The amendment is passed. Amendment is adopted.
Okay. So I was explaining it to you, and I guess that's done now. So... maybe we could hear a little testimony from Ms. Manning and Michelle.
Mary Manning, Minnesota Department of Health. We conducted a study in 2004-2006. The purpose of the project was to assess the impact of home assessments and modifications on children who had poorly controlled asthma. What we found, we were working with a federal grant we had gotten from EPA. We worked with the American Lung Association, who had also gotten a grant from CDC, and we worked with the City of Minneapolis, who had gotten a HUD grant. And all these grants had other components to them, but this was one that we all had in common. What we found is our intervention, we call it the RITA Project, Reducing Environmental Triggers of Asthma. We had in-home education on the proper use of medical administration of medication. We had an assessment of the home. There was an environmental assessment of the home and the triggers that were in the home that would have aggravated the asthma. And then we also had the provision of low-cost interventions, things like HEPA vacuum cleaners, HEPA air cleaners, and mattress covers and such to limit the exposure. What we found is that we did some baseline measures, and what we found after the intervention, 12 months later, that hospital visits had declined on average by one, unscheduled office visits had declined by two, and there was a decrease in the amount of days that these children were out. On average, they were out 7 days, so much higher, but a year after the intervention took place, they only had missed 1 day of school. So we costed that intervention, the cost of the intervention, the cost of bringing the medical provider into the home to do the assessment, the cost of the durable equipment, and subtracted it from what we perceived was the cost savings from the hospital visit and the two unscheduled visits, and came with a savings per child of $1,960. And you have a fact sheet that's dated September 2007, because our project was in 04 to 06, and our results were put in this. So that's the that was the impetus of the legislation that Representative Hart proposed. Liza? Representative Clark, the committee, the hospital savings that we thought we saved $2,428 because that was the cost on average per hospital visit. So from the baseline measure to 12 months later, that was the cost that we determined we saved per child. That is hospitalization.
That was just hospital visit.
Oh, hospital utilization. Yes. Yeah.
Do you have a different one? No, that's okay.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Hi, thank you very much. My name is Eliza Schell. I work with the City of Minneapolis. I work in a department called Healthy Homes and Lead Hazard Control. For the past 3 years, our department has been federally funded to do asthma assessments in the home and asthma interventions, providing products such as the Rita Project had described, HEPA vacuums, air cleaners, whole house furnace filters, dehumidifiers, basically all of the items that this bill would provide for American Indian children. It's almost a direct model. Over the 3 years, we had received $1 million. We worked in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Hennepin County, Ramsey County. We helped over 953 children. We did 647 units of housing, primarily rental housing. And we saw a lot of families. Most of our families were on medical assistance and were severely impacted with asthma that was uncontrolled. The home environment had never been looked at as potential triggers. And so we went in, identified the triggers per household. Sometimes they were very simple, you know, dust mites being the biggest asthma triggers. So we really focus on reduction of dust mites in the home and specifically in the child's bedroom because that's where they spend over 8 hours a day and that's where they need to try to sleep. That's where a lot of our interventions, the products were placed. But we found that a lot of families did not have simple tools like vacuums. They were sweeping their carpets, which of course is a big no-no for anyone with asthma or respiratory diseases. The majority of our clients were very low income or extremely low income. We have 95% of the families we saw. So we saw 647 families, give or take, possibly higher. This is just reported in general. We did see families over a year's period of time. We studied them at baseline. We studied them at 3 months, and we studied them at 12 months and did follow-up surveying to see what types of impacts simple cleaning tools and air purifiers and asthma trigger reduction could do, as well as look at asthma education and provide asthma management. Am I saying that right? Asthma management plans, so written plans for the family to help deal with their child's asthma in the home, in school, in daycares, things like that. There's a handout. It's a two-pager. And we went through the cost of the products because I think that seems to be what people are talking about. Oh, these are expensive. You know, we can't necessarily pay for these. Well, I can tell you HUD has paid for these products for the last 6 years. And find it very valuable. Our study is the largest study in the United States that we are contributing health data to HUD. Now that funding has run out, there's no more federal funding, and these children are still at need, and we are trying to find local sustainable solutions. If you look at the product costs, I mean, an air cleaner is $150. That goes in a child's bedroom. The bedding and pillow encasements, very low cost. The HEPA vacuum, $143. Furnace filters, $20. Dehumidifier tubing. So there, we saw a lot of housing issues and a lot of pest infestation. I don't know if you all know, but the number one trigger and cause of asthma right now is dust mites. The number two trigger in inner city children is roaches. And we have roach problems in our cities that are usually in multifamily properties. We've got the poorest of the poor. We've got the most sick people in these properties, and they need assistance. Our study, unfortunately, did not get to the American Indian population. We worked with all of the clinics, all of the hospitals. We took referrals from respiratory clinics. So it really was the physicians that got us the children for our study. However, I believe that there is a great need for American Indian children to receive this benefit and to be targeted for this type of program.
Michelle, we have a question from Representative House.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Clark, I see you have, and this must be what you passed before, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. Are those three cities because of environmental exposures that are there in the ground or in the air? I mean, I'd like to know why you're eliminating a place like Cass Lake.
Representative House, what a great question. I would never eliminate Cass Lake if I wasn't forced to with the appropriation dollars that we had available to us last time, because I think that we could probably have a whole bill just for Cass Lake. What this was looking at population centers of American Indian kids who are in inner cities, and we're starting with that, and it's a very limited pilot project. One of the things we know about asthma, it wasn't mentioned today, but was in our testimony last time, asthma is the number one reason kids miss school. American Indian kids have the highest disparity and achievement gap in our cities there. So we're starting with that as a very limited pilot, but I'll tell you, when I brought this bill in, I intended it to cover everybody. It wasn't just children, it was adults and children. The needs of the limitations of the appropriations process last time, I remember I was in Representative Thiessen's committee, and the first thing he did was amend the bill to have it limited only to children and only to children on public assistance. As we went through the process and the dollars cut back and back and back, we ended up with just this pilot demonstration project. And my hope is that we will show that it is so effective, as these two studies did, in terms of helping children who have severe asthma recover and have less hospitalizations, expensive hospitalization, other kinds of interventions that they need, and help them succeed in school, stay in school more too. I think the numbers were 7 to 1. 7 days that they missed as compared to 1 day when they had these simple things brought to their home where they could, you know, have their air, their breathing be better. So I want to assure you that if we can go through this process and we are able in our next biennium to have appropriation dollars in this committee, I would very much like to include, you know, many more parts of the state, including certainly Cass Lake.
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative House.
I just a recommendation to the folks here. I see on the list of things and the cost. I know that you can get a very, very good vacuum cleaner for $49.95. That's what the price we pay up north. It's excellent. It lasts a long time. It's durable. And the other thing I think you should look at, and this doesn't have anything to do with Native American or Chinese or white or blue, I'll bet you 50% to 60% of these kids that have asthma problems have domestic pets. And I know you can't say to someone, well, we have to get rid of your pet, but there has to be a gentle way that you can somehow restrict that, because I'll bet you 60% have a domestic pet that causes half of their asthma and allergy attacks.
Is that
Representative
Harvey?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll try to answer that. first question was, or the first comment was about the vacuum cleaner. And certainly there are vacuums that are really affordable, and they are generally very small. They don't use bags, and they're not advised for children with asthma. We have the vacuums that we provided were specifically for people with breathing problems. They use HEPA filters, which are very expensive generally. The HEPA vacuums generally run upwards of $400. We negotiated very carefully with contractors, and we've got discounts based on our bulk purchasing to get that price that you see there. And the second question, or the second comment, is yes, we did see families with pets. That the 60% does sound correct for what we're talking about here. Now, the thing that our part of our intervention was to educate on and letting those parents know to change that behavior so that that pet wasn't inside the child's bedroom and that that would be their safe haven. That's why we put a basic, if the child was having issues, they could go into the bedroom, close the door, turn on the HEPA air cleaner, lay on the bed that's specifically treated, and do their nebulizer treatments or do whatever kind of medical treatment they need in that safe area.
All right, thank you. And Representative Clark, do you have a quick question? And I think we should move on. Scott.
Yes. Thank you.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned local sustainable solutions that you'd been looking for, and I'm just wondering what those might have been, what you've tried.
Madam Chair, Representative, actually, I think that's why we're here. Is to find some sort of local support for this type of program. There's definitely a need. Now we have to find funding.
Representative Scott?
Yes, just a follow-up question. Have you tried some of the tribes, Shakopee or Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, any of those, as far as I know they have resources that they fund such things. Have you tried that avenue?
Michelle? No.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I do know that the tribes are working very diligently on receiving funding as well. So they go through their own seeking out funding for this process and are very limited to foundations and things like that. So, yes, there is efforts. There's quite a few community stakeholders that are all vying for resources, and we are trying to get the job done.
All right, thank you. And I think with that, Representative Clark renews her motion that House File 2582, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed? The bill is passed.
And re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Representative Hayden, welcome back to your committee. We've had extensive testimony on your bill before we were in session, so now you can move your bill, and it'll be officially before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, and members, I move House File 2604 to, I guess I don't know where it's going.
It would be referred to the Committee on Finance, and from there it goes.
Okay, be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Yes, Madam Chair, shouldn't that be referred to Commerce?
Actually, I thought we were going through Finance. Maybe that's
did it come here from
Excuse me, I'm wrong. Hold on a second. I guess it goes to Finance first, and then it goes to Commerce. We have the system changed a little bit in the last 2 years. All right. Representative Hayden, you want to give us some comments? And I believe there, we had extensive testimony. We had one person who wanted to testify today, and we will allow that, but we're just going to take one testimony because we had a whole big session on this before, and this particular person, their industry was represented, but we'll ask Representative Hayden. He's willing to allow that one to testify today. So go ahead, Representative Hayden, just if you want to summarize the bill so
sure.
Committee members who may not have been at the hearing can understand it, and then we'll go over that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 2604 is the stay of mortgage foreclosure and tenant rights, which is asking for that the legislature call a state of emergency on foreclosures due to the economic conditions of the state, and that we have a moratorium on foreclosures for 2 years. And that essentially would be when someone went into foreclosure, they would be willing to petition that they not be foreclosed upon. It does not mean that they wouldn't pay their mortgage. There is a formula in the bill that they would either work something out with the bank, or that they would continue to make payments. And the kind of basic premise would be about 41% of their household income would be their payment as they went through the foreclosure process, hoping to work something out with their bank. One of the things that has happened, we all know about the foreclosure crisis. The numbers have been in the paper extensively, large numbers of foreclosures in all over the state and all over the nation. And the thing that I think we are really focusing on with this bill is to think about foreclosures in the context of a lot of people are being foreclosed upon initially because there were these really bad, toxic subprime loans. Now, because of that process and the continuing destabilization of the economy, people are now losing their jobs and are unable to make the payments. Property values are increasingly becoming less than what the value of the mortgage, which compounds the issue. So what we're hoping to do is to bring light to this issue and stabilize communities, stabilize people's homes, and allow them to sit down and kind of work out these issues with the banks. There are federal programs that are underway that we have heard great testimony that says that people have not been able to really work these things out with their banks, not because of their lack of trying, but because of issues that they're having with their banks, and for whatever reasons, banks not always utilizing the program that the federal government has put in place is one of the issues. Along with the foreclosure moratorium, we also have language that allows tenants to have additional rights if they are in a situation in which their building or where they're living is being foreclosed upon, and it allows them to continue to live there and not be evicted for the simple fact that their landlord or property manager or whoever owns the property is in foreclosure. It does not, though, allow tenants not to pay, and it does not. There's a whole list of cause, meaning that if you are going to evict the tenant through the foreclosure process, then you have to do it with cause. That being said, members, I know that we don't have a lot of time, and we do have testimony from the banks. I would like to say this, that this bill has a long ways to go yet. In our last hearing, I had spoken to Representative Howes and others from the realtor industry and the banking industry that we would work together. Just because of the session and the pace of the session, we haven't been able to get together yet. So there is still a lot of room for negotiation, and I wanted to make sure that, as I said in the hearing before, that I still intend on having those conversations and those meetings, and we just haven't been able to do that to this point. So with that, Madam Chairman, we'll have the testifier and question.
Let me just make a correction here, too. Thank you, Representative Scott. It is going to be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor first. Okay, so that's where it'll go next. And as was mentioned, there's probably several stops for this bill. If you want to, I know you were willing to yes. have the, I believe Mr. Skilbred. Can testify, and if you could make your testimony short, we did have extensive testimony at the last meeting, and did provide an opportunity for other bankers to testify. So, if you could be brief, but we want to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hayden. David Skillbred with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. I'll make this very brief. Number one, independent community bankers are privately held. They're the small banks out there. They're family-owned banks, more like small businesses than anything else. Number two, if you think about the community bank, you know, I'm sure you'll understand and believe that they are available to their customers in all situations. And foreclosure is an absolute last resort in any time, but especially in these times. Testimony last committee meeting brought up FHA, and I just want to mention that FHA is primarily a program for first-time home buyers. They have lower credit scores, higher debt-to-income ratio. FHA offers a lower down payment of 3.5%. So the number of mortgages out there that are FHA insured are a small minority of all mortgages, probably less than, I would bet less than 10%. I would guess down around 5%. So while those may be insured, the vast majority are not. Furthermore, if you do foreclose on an FHA loan, you have a lot of losses post the foreclosure that are not covered. So even in those cases, there are losses. Furthermore, my banks do not hold FHA loans. You need to be an FHA lender, certified lender. My community banks are not such. So the loans that we do hold would not be FHA insured and would be covered by this. Again, we are available to all of our customers. We'll try to avoid foreclosure in every case. One thing I want to bring to your mind is that this is a very well-intentioned bill. We understand the need for it and why people want to pursue this solution. It runs counter to our regulatory system and our examiners, however. Examiners want a long-term fix, not a short-term fix. Examiners want to know what is the exit strategy. Examiners want to know that a loan is underwritten to standards that they approve of. And if they are not, then the bank will need to reserve or set aside funds for these loans. And this bill would make that requirement for that two-year period. The result of this is that capital issues are going to become an issue for banks with these sort of loans on their books. That will reduce capital to be used for other purposes. And so it really puts banks in a bind with their examiners if this were to become law. With that, I'll hold my testimony. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Skubert. Okay. Let's see, I think there were a couple of questions. And I'm not sure if Representative Howells had his hand up. But did you or did you not?
I have a question.
You did have your hand up. Okay, and then Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hayden, thank you for talking to me about this bill before committee started. The governor will veto the bill in its current form. You're aware of that. And I'm just, if you're not, I'm reminding you. I still think you have the foundation for something that could work. It just needs... it needs help. And I'm going to show you one part of where it really needs help, and I'm just shocked that nobody gets it. On page 5, line 1, we're talking about somebody that's renting an apartment, and whoever owns this massive apartment building went broke, and the bank now owns it, so this renter's renting from the bank, typically. And they should... their current monthly payment is what they should pay. That's fair. But then you've got language in here that you have on the homeowner's side, or 41% based on the borrower's documented and verified monthly income. That should have absolutely no bearing on this. The renter didn't default on his rent. It's not the bank's fault that this thing happened. Whereas the homeowner defaulted on his loan, probably because he didn't have a job or has a job that pays him less, so it applies to that. But if you're to have a 100-unit apartment building, and they're all paying, let's say, $600 a month rent, and somebody reads this bill after it's passed and says, well, now the bank owns this building, I bet I can get my rent cut all the way down to 41% of my income, not count my wife's income, and I got a deal here. That part should not be in the bill at all, because there's no reason for it to be. It's not a factor in the default. It's not a factor in the monthly payment. I hope I'm explaining myself correctly.
Representative Hayden.
No, I was just trying to follow your process in saying that on the homeowner side, while they are negotiating and trying to find their way through the process, the 41%, they would still have to pay 41%, at least 41% of their income. Just on the rental side, I didn't see the language. I'm sorry. I think I wasn't.
Well, it's the top of page 5, those first 3 lines. And what you're saying here is the renter should, yes, to stay there, continue to abide by the rules of his lease or her lease, and continue paying the existing monthly
rent. Oh, okay. I see what you're
saying. But there should be no discussion about percentage of income, because then you've got 100 renters that are going to go to the bank all of a sudden and say, wait a minute, we want a deal here.
Now the bank is
stuck not only with trying to sell or fix this thing, but now dealing with income of every renter.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative House, I do see that, and that would be something that we'd have to tighten up. I think that the intent of the bill is that the renter would continue to pay their rent that they had negotiated to the property manager, the bank, or whoever, and the idea would be that they wouldn't. There were so many people that were getting kicked out. They were paying their rent as they should, were getting kicked out because the property was changing hands, and we were hopefully allowing those folks to stay. So you're right, we need to kind of tighten that up.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hayden, I want to thank you for doing what you can to work on this bill. I agree with Representative Howes. There's some work that needs to be done. You've committed to doing that work. It's going to go to Commerce Committee. I think the major concerns about this bill are commerce-related issues and not housing-related issues. I think everybody agrees we've got a housing problem. It's hitting all of our communities, foreclosures and people on the verge of foreclosure. So I think you should be commended for trying to do something, and I hope you'll, as this bill moves forward, particularly to the Commerce Committee, I hope you'll work to find a way to get more people on board, and I appreciate you doing that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the bill is before... Oh, Representative McFarland, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I also want to echo what Representative Morgan said. I think, for one thing, I think there's 2 different sections of this bill. It's almost better that they go separately, in my opinion. The other thing that... I can't support it in its current form, but I would like to see it move forward. The other thing is there's no definition of what an emergency declared to exist is. I mean, what are the economic conditions? I mean, I think if you're going to put this in statute, there better be a definition, I would suggest. And there's other things, too, but I'd be glad to help with any way I can.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, thank you for that. And I would love and would welcome support from anyone on the committee on this issue to try to define this and maybe tighten it up a bit to make sure that we get a bill that, as Representative Housewood said, would be ready for the governor to sign. I would love that support.
One final comment, Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize. I was not able to make the previous hearings. There's a lot of stuff in this bill. And I think the housing issue in particular is germane to this committee. I think it would have been my hopes, Madam Chair, that we would have had more than 25 minutes to discuss this bill and actually do what we as a committee are supposed to be doing, and that's address the issues that regard this committee rather than just saying, oh, we're going to work together and we're going to push this bill onto the next committee and then hopefully it'll go through the process. That's our job as the committee, is on housing issues, is to address those housing issues and have due diligence in terms of the time dedicated to this. I'm not voting for it simply because I don't think we did that in this committee, and I don't think we've had the opportunity. We just got into session last Thursday. I don't think this is such a crisis situation that we can't have the full deliberation that this bill should entail. I agree that there's some issues out there dealing with housing and foreclosures. That's not the issue here. The issue is, are we going to properly address the bill? And, Madam Chair, I appreciate the time and the ability to speak out, but the bottom line is I think we haven't given this housing position in this committee the due diligence that we need to in the time constraints. And I apologize I wasn't able to make it. There are other things that were going on, and I would have liked to. So Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. I just will remind committee members, we had an extensive joint committee hearing with another committee on this, so we could have a lot of discussion, and we did. So, Representative Hayden, the bill, final bill is before us. Representative Scott, do you feel the need to comment first?
Wasn't that meeting primarily just testimony? It really wasn't right. Bill explanation, though.
I mean, that's Representative Scott. We did have a test. Representative Hayden went through the bill. So, House File 2604 is Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Madam Chair, just based on, I was not able to attend the hearing and the discussion here, not knowing really what it was all about. I'd like to move the recommendation from being recommended to pass to moved without recommendation to the Committee on Commerce and ask for a roll call.
So we have a motion to move the bill as recommended to pass, and you want to amend the motion?
Correct.
To have it recommended to pass with no...
Without a recommendation, just based on conflicting testimony here, I think it would be better if we're going to actually move it.
To pass without recommendation is what you're saying.
Forward without recommendation.
Okay. The amendment is before us, an oral amendment from Representative McNamara. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no? No.
Oh.
I think we need... Oh, I'm sorry. You wanted a roll call? I made a mistake.
Depends on how you're going
to... I'm very sorry. Very sorry.
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry. We'll go. We will call the roll. I'm so sorry. My mistake. You want me to vote?
Yeah. Do you want to clarify?
Clerk votes no.
Do you want to clarify what we're voting on?
We're voting on the amendment to that Representative McNamara has offered, which is to amend the bill to pass without recommendation, to move forward without recommendation to the Commerce Committee. And Clerk votes no.
Benson?
Aye.
Bly?
No.
Hayden?
No.
Howes? Huntley?
No.
Lane?
No.
McFarland?
Aye.
McNamara?
Aye.
Morgan?
Aye.
Rosenthal? Saylor?
Aye.
Scott? Severson.
Aye.
Okay. The McNamara resolution or amendment does pass 7-5. The bill will then go forward without recommendation to the Commerce Committee. That final motion is before us as amended. Any final words? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
Motion prevails, and the House File 2604 is on its way to the Commerce Committee. Members, I just wanted to point out that we have pages with us, and they're new to our committee, and I'd just like to introduce them. Danielle Smith on our left. Danielle, welcome. We really appreciate your being here. And Sarah Kramer on the right. Thank you so much. You will help make our work possible. Committee is adjourned.